I'm glad we're all on the same page.
Can you guys hear me?
Yep.
Okay, cool. My internet's being a little funky today, so I had to move into a different room. So hopefully it holds out for us. Okay, let's see. How's everybody feeling? How are you guys holding up? Okay, so we, as you know, extended the Shell Lab deadline to tonight, and hopefully that is being kind to everybody. I haven't even looked at Auto Lab. So I can do some help hours today, but I won't be back. I have to do something right after class. I won't be back till about 3:30. So if you are looking at your Shell Lab and you need some help, I will be around then. But just know that like some of this debugging stuff, like even like if you've been in help hours already, you've probably seen this. Sometimes the debugging is like really fickle and difficult, even for like me and Matt and David and Saroj. Like we can look at your functions and they can look totally fine, and like they should be working, and because some other part of your code is not working, it's not doing what it's supposed to be doing, and you know, thus is the nature of debugging code. So if you still have debugging to do, make sure you're start working on that like right after class, and make sure you're giving yourself enough time. If you guys do end up like needing a little bit of extra time, please reach out to me and we'll see what we can do. Everything is weird, and the main thing is like we want you guys to do this lab. And like I said before, this is like really important. This is probably the most important thing you do in systems, because your other classes that you take, that you all know systems is like a bottleneck course. That's why we added this second section. So we have so many students who kind of get caught up in that bottleneck to be able to take other computer science courses. But the reason for that is that the things that we do in systems are really important to those future classes, and specifically the things that relate to Shell Lab, like processes. Processes are huge. When you get to operating systems, the stuff that we're doing right now, you're going to go way in depth too. So even though we're just kind of like touching, like dipping our toes into 9 and 10, even that like little conceptual intro, you know how much easier it is to learn something if you get the chance to hear it a couple of times. So even just having that little conceptual intro, don't stress yourselves out about like understanding mapping algorithms and stuff if you're reading the book, because that gets really complex, and that's the kind of stuff that you're going to be doing in operating systems. But OS will fully expect for you to have like a good handle on like things like synchronization and race conditions and processes, and that class will move quickly and will not wait for you to learn that stuff if you haven't learned it yet. So we think this is really important. We want to make sure that you guys actually do Shell Lab. If that means that you end up needing a little bit extra time, you know, even if you turn in what you have now and you have to come back after Attack Lab or something and like work on it further, the important thing here is for you guys to have like a solid grasp of it. Like that's what we really, really want. It's kind of like the goal of the course. So having all this stuff happen like in the middle of Shell Lab is like very inopportune. Not that there was ever like a good point in the semester for it, but after Shell Lab would have been better. So keep working on it. If you have questions, keep asking questions. Try and get it done tonight, because we're gonna, you know how we are, we're gonna move on to Attack Lab probably Wednesday. Yes, if you haven't used your grace day, it'll still get applied. I think because of the way that things are, just if you need anything extra from us, or if there's anything we can do, like, just email us. Like, we know that, like, this situation is not ideal, like I said before. So yeah, if you haven't used your grace day yet, it'll automatically get applied for you to turn it in tomorrow at midnight. I think we're either going to start a TAC lab on Wednesday, if not Wednesday, definitely on Friday, because we have to do a bunch of setup stuff for that, and that might take us a little extra time. Plus, we're still doing a little bit of the memory stuff, and we'll get into the virtual memory too. So we'll probably finish that up today and Wednesday, and either assign a TAC lab Wednesday or a TAC lab Friday. You don't want to be working on two labs at the same time. The way that we had this semester set up already actually is kind of fortuitous for us, because of where spring break was, Mardi Gras break, like, we had to rush a bunch of stuff early in the semester. So we actually already have a little bit of extra time after a TAC lab. So if we finish a TAC lab and you guys want to go back and keep working through some of the shell lab stuff that maybe you don't understand, like, we can definitely also do that, but we will still be learning other stuff. So that's, like, last resort. That's, like, if things are going really poorly for you right now. Don't try not to do that, because, you know, the end of the semester is not, like we've talked about before, it's not going to be easier in your other classes. You don't want to, like, push shell lab, now that you've experienced some of it, to when you're, like, studying for finals and all the other stuff and all your other courses is coming up. So if you have any questions about that, just email. We're trying to be here to help you guys as much as we can. So hopefully that is helpful and coming across. And yes. Any questions? Okay, cool. That is a no. I keep getting little notifications on my screen that my internet is unstable. So if at any point I, like, freeze or something happens, just holler at me in the chat or raise your hand and I will try and stop and re-go over something or hold out for my, I don't know why my internet's being like this today. This is just, it's just a thing. Okay. Let me. Get to where we need to go for caching. I'm going to go back here. Okay. Hey, I don't know what just happened. Are you guys still seeing my screen?
I'm seeing your fish.
All right, hold on. Now you're seeing my screen?
Yep.
Okay. There was a doorbell and then I lost everything. Okay, so we talked about the different kinds of misses and what that means. And really the important thing there is just knowing that a cash hit is whenever we are looking for something in cash and it's already there. A cash miss is when we're looking for something in cash and it's not there and we have to go fetch it from memory somewhere else. And let's breeze past that little guy. Okay, so we talked about all of the stuff we've talked about with caching so far has been like reading from memory. When we talk about writing from memory, we have to think about it a little bit differently. And here's why. So when we're caching, we have multiple copies of the same data, different places in our system, right? We may have it in different caches. We probably have it like in our main memory or our disk. So whenever we do a write, we have to make sure that it actually gets written, not just in the cache, but also to memory or to disk, right? So the question is like, when should we do that and how should we do that to make sure that we are being efficient and also to make sure that that memory that gets changed when we're working with it in cache also gets changed other places in memory. And there are a couple of ways that we can do this. So we can write through, which means that anything that we change in our cache, we will immediately change other places in memory. So we'll immediately like go to wherever we're pulling that other memory from, wherever we're catching that memory from, and we will change it there as well. And does anybody see why that could be like not the best scenario? So like if we are caching, if we're caching for disk, that time to go get data and read and write is really expensive. So if we're doing a bunch of writes, that could be like very expensive computationally. That might be using a lot of extra time that we don't really want to be using. So this other thing that we can do is write back, which means that anything that we update in cache, in like a block of cache, we will mark. And we're gonna mark it by setting a bit. So in cache, we know that like if this like dirty bit is set, we have a line that is different than what it is in memory. And we just hold on to that until, really until like the very last minute. So we want to wait as long as we can to do that write to memory because those writes can be expensive. So we will wait until that block of memory in cache is about to get evicted and overwritten. And then when something is about to be evicted, like a block is going to be evicted, that we will check to see if that dirty bit is set, if we need to like write some other, if we need to overwrite that part in memory or not. And we'll do that before we evict that block in cache, right? That makes sense. So that means that like if we've done that's really helpful because if we've done multiple writes in that block of memory, that means we can do all of those writes, or in that block of cache, we can do all of those writes to memory at the same time rather than going back and forth and back and forth. So depending on like the cost of going to whatever memory you're caching, that can also be a good option. Or if like locality is serving you and you're doing multiple writes, say you're like, you know, changing the same variable again and again or something. So what do we do if we need to write something that's like not in our cache already? So we want to write something to some memory and it's not already in our cache. So this is a write version of a miss rather than a read version of a miss. So we can do two things here too. We can either do write allocate, which means we'll take that block of memory and we'll load it into our cache and we'll update that line in cache. And then that will get updated in memory depending on how, if we're doing write through or write back at some point. So either that will get updated right away or it'll get updated whenever that block of memory gets evicted again. And this can be really good if with locality we're doing a lot of writes to that block of memory, right? So if we are going to do a lot of writes, if we have a write miss, loading that, using that extra time to load that block of memory into our cache is not a bad idea, because if we are using good locality, then there's a good chance that we're going to do more writes to that block of memory or more reads from that block of memory, and having it there will be helpful for us. We can also not load it into cache and just go ahead and write straight to memory. So that's another option. And different caches do different things. You don't have to know how each cache operates. A good rule of thumb is just to kind of guess that with writes, we're going to do write back for write hits and write allocate for write misses. And that is nice. So the right allocate is kind of like the symmetrical version of like a read miss. So just think of a write miss as a read miss. It's gonna do the same thing. I'll load it up into cache and do that as well. So that way we have like the same thing happening with our write and our read misses. You don't have to like remember the other stuff. But just FYI, there are multiple ways to do that. Any questions about that? Okay, cool. Okay, so I think we already talked about this. Let me see what's next. Okay, so we already talked about like why this is important for you guys to know. We are able to improve the performance and the speed of our programs if we write them with locality in mind. And it's because of this like caching that we do that we're able to do that. I think we've talked pretty much in depth about that with the read stuff. So this is just another little summary. I think we've already actually even seen this summary slide. But does anybody have any questions about how like locality and caching work together and like complement each other to help narrow that speed gap that we saw in that graph when we first started talking about this stuff? Yeah, I think we've talked about it quite a bit, and I think that it becomes evident the more you think at it and look at it how all of these things kind of fit together. Okay, so let's talk about, now that we're talking about how those things work together to help with performance, let's talk about those actual performance metrics. So we utilize miss rate, which means that our miss rate is our fraction of memory not found in cache. So our fraction of misses equals 1 minus the hit rate. So typical numbers for this, typical miss rates can be like 3 to 10% for L1, and they can be like much smaller than that for things like L2, less than 1% is not uncommon. So our hit time is the time that it takes to deliver some line, some block in cache to the processor. And this includes the time to determine whether or not the line is in cache. So that include the hit time includes the time to check to see if the block of code with the line that we need is already in our cache, and the time that it takes to deliver that line to the processor. And typical numbers for that are gonna be 4 clock cycles for L1 and 10 clock cycles for L2. So that's our hit time. Our miss penalty can get really big. So our miss penalty is our hit time, the time it takes to check to see whether or not that that block of memory is already in cache. And then also, if it's not there, that means the time to go fetch that block from main memory and transfer it into our, and copy it into our cache, right? So this can be anywhere from 50 to 200 cycles for main memory. So that is a lot more than our hit time, right? So we really, 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 it's important as far as like efficiency to try and minimize misses. Okay, like I said, there's a huge difference between a hit and a miss. It could be the difference of like 100 times if we're looking at L1 and main memory. It could be even more, obviously, if we're looking at other caching. So think about this. So actually, when we're looking at these kind, this kind of efficiency with caching, 99% hits is twice as good as 97% hits. And the way that we can see this is, consider if we have a cache hit time of 1 cycle. So that includes the time that it takes to like see if that is in cache and to fetch that bit of data. And then our miss penalty is 100 cycles. So If we have 97% hits, that means that our average access time will be one cycle plus our miss percentage times 100 cycles. So that brings our average access time down to 4 cycles. Whereas if we have 99% hits, we've got one cycle plus our miss percentage time times the miss percentage times the miss cycles. That'll be 2 cycles. So that's having 2% less misses will actually double our average access time, which is huge. So this is really, really important. Our miss rate is really important to the performance of our programs and systems. And this is also really important. So being able to utilize our caches to, like, when you're programming, to be able to program, you may not be able to do things in Java or Python or C that directly call on caches or direct your caching, but you can be mindful of the way that our caches work and kind of program with those caches in mind. So doing things like focusing on the inner loops where the bulk of our computations and memory accesses occur, that is important. It's also, I don't know, this is the next slide, hold on. Oh, this is the last slide. So a couple things are important. First of all, being able to use local variables is great because if you remember in C, if we have local variables, those can be stored in registers, and that's like ideal. Register access is like instant. So being able to, and remember, whenever we did our calling convention stuff, if we like can pass in and use local variables, that all gets assigned to registers. So that's great. Utilizing local variables is great. As far as global variables, that might not help us as much. We don't really know where those could be stored. We don't have as much control over that. So that's one thing. And then also using that temporal locality and making sure that if like you're in a function, if you're doing some sort of like variable read or write, you're using that variable again and again in that function. Maximizing spatial locality. So this is what we talked about when we talked about like arrays. So if we grab some block of data and bring it into our cache and there is memory there that is like the address of like some array, remember that like if we do this stride one, which means that we like move through the array like one index at a time, that will help, that helps us much, much more than if we do like a stride two where we're like skipping over indexes, because then we may need to even pull other blocks of memory into our cache to get through some like bigger arrays or multi-dimensional arrays. And if we can avoid that and not have to be jumping around so much, that's really helpful as far as efficiency. Anybody have any questions about caching? We're going to move on. Okay. Let me pull up our next slide set. We're going to move on to virtual memory. Okay, so let's get going. Now we're on to chapter 10. Again, we're just kind of dipping our toes into 10. So if you are somebody who likes to look at the
I think you disconnected. Your mic is muted.
When did that happen? Why is this doorbell thing happening?
Who knows?
Can you guys hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Zoom is fun. It's actually fine. This is like the first day I've had issues with it. I guess maybe that's just notifying me that I'm muted for some reason. Maybe that has something to do with my internet access today. Okay, as I was saying, sorry, I got a little lost there for a second. We're just going to kind of dip our toes into the virtual memory. Things that we may expect you to know as far as like caching and memory are going to be the memory hierarchy, that pyramid, the meaningfulness of it, how it's like structured and why. And those sound like really complex questions, but they're actually pretty simple answers for it. And then also things like, can you look at this set of nested for loops and tell whether or not we have good locality or something like that, you know? So none of that, you don't have to worry about any of the arithmetic stuff. We're not gonna test you on that. This is just an intro for you guys, really. Although it is, this all goes hand in hand with processes and how we program, and so it is really important. Okay, so moving on, we're going to start looking at virtual memory. So let us begin. Okay, so the way that we have looked at our memory, if we think back, let's just keep Bomb Lab in mind when we're talking about this stuff, right? Because that was our first interaction with GDB, which may have been your first interaction with seeing how instructions and code and data are laid out in memory, right? So we open GDB and we see, we set some breakpoint, and then we're able to see some instructions and how they are sequenced in our memory and how they call and do different things. So we are used to that. We know that each byte of our memory has an address. So we're used to seeing those addresses, those hexadecimal addresses. We've all been there. We're all familiar. So let's actually look at some Bomb Lab stuff. Here we have an old semester's version of BOM 3. So this is an OBJ dump. So we can see here, we've got this sequence of addresses that correspond to this bytecode that gets translated into assembly instructions, right? So we've got 400DA7, and at that address in memory, we have an instruction that says we want to call initialize BOM, and initialize BOM lives at this other place in memory, 40174C. So you can see like we're using this addressing a lot, right? We're gonna move something from memory from this address 4025B8 into EDI. So we're gonna move some stuff into our registers. We're gonna call another function that's gonna write that thing, that data that we just pulled from that address into EDI to screen. So if we look at this very last, this very last two instructions, we can see we move, and this instruction is at 400DD2. So that's where the instruction is in memory. And that instruction is telling us that we're going to move some data that's at 402628. We're going to move that into one of our registers, into EDI. And then when we call this function, put s, we're going to write what is in EDI onto our screen. And that function lives at this other address, right? And so if we were to look at and examine this place in memory where we moved, what we moved into EDI with this, XS that we used a lot, we would see that the string is phase one diffused. How about the next one? And as we know, like that string is actually just a character array. So What is actually in memory at 402628 is the P. And, you know, 402629 will be the H, and A will be the A, and B will be the S, et cetera, and so on and so on. Everybody got that? That all makes sense. Like, I like this stuff because I feel like it's bringing everything we've learned together and, like, really kind of is showing us, like, how our system, like, works. And I don't know, before I took this class, I didn't have any idea how much stuff was going on under the hood. I was like, yeah, computers are smart, but also magic, who knows? But I think this is, like, a really cool, even though we don't go really in depth into it, I think this is a really cool kind of, like, coming together of some of these concepts to really understand, like, what is going on underneath the hood and how these programs are executing. So here's the thing. You know that when we were doing Bomb Lab, like, everybody had their different bombs, and some bombs were the same, and, you know, I think we had four different bombs. So you had a bomb that was likely different from, you know, your classmates' bombs. But even if you, like, ended up having some version of the bomb that was, you know, similar, you hopefully didn't think that, like, oh, you know, my friend said that the answer to this, this phase is at this place in memory. So if I just do an excess on this memory address, I should get my string for phase one, right? And that wouldn't have worked for you because they were all a little bit different. So let's look at this. We're gonna also look at this as bomb 46. So this is an OBJ dump of this same part of this program. So we're starting at the same place in memory, 400 DA7. We have this same call to this function initialized bomb, but notice that initialized bomb here lives someplace else in memory, right? So that stuff's gonna be a little bit different. We're gonna be calling different places in memory. I'm just gonna move back and forth so you can, like, believe that what I'm telling you is true. So some stuff might be the same. Our put s function is in the same place, but a lot of things will be just a little bit different, right? So you can't quite, you can't count on that stuff being the same. And let's talk about why. Let's talk about processes again and remind ourselves of some of these fundamental characteristics of our processes. So remember when we introduced you to processes, we told you, and maybe this wasn't that meaningful at the time, that every process thinks it is the only process in the system. It thinks it has exclusive access to all memory, right? So every process will start somewhere, like, you know, in these, you probably saw somewhere in these 4000s, usually there's some system stuff that usually ends up taking up this code in here, some, like, booting stuff. And then it will go to some, like, large address in memory up here, and it has all of its, like, data and its heap and its stack and the shared libraries. All of that stuff is in there as well. So this process thinks that, like, what it's got going on is it for that computer. And actually, it used to be how it was. So if you look at, like, old computers, and probably most of you never had experience with these, but when I was a little kid, we had a computer in the garage, and I could go play games on it because we had number crunchers and stuff on a floppy disk. And all I would do is put that floppy disk into the computer, and my computer could only run whatever was on that disk, right? So that process was the only process on the system. It did have exclusive access to memory. That's obviously not how our computers work anymore. We can do tons of stuff at once. So how do these processes all use these same addresses and nobody gets confused, right? Nobody is actually, like, overwriting each other. No one is taking anybody else's data. The way that we accomplish this is by utilizing virtual memory. Let me see what that, oh, there we go. So here's an example. These two processes, they could be the same program, they could be different programs. Even if it's the same program, like, looking at the same places in memory, Like, it's not, they're not going to interfere with each other. They're basically isolated in a sandbox processes. They have no awareness of anything else that's going on in the system. And this, you know, can continue on for however many processes we have going on. So how does this work? Like I said, we accomplish this by utilizing virtual memory, and we will talk about virtual memory, but first we'll talk about what we're used to, which is this like physical memory addressing. So this is what we have been kind of probably thinking happens on our system. We have our CPU. Our CPU wants to access some data in this part of main memory in this physical address 4, and it just looks for physical address 4, and there it is. Like, it looks at that word that starts at 4, and there is still some there are still some processors and some systems that work this way, like really simple stuff, things that we have in our cars right now or in elevators, picture frames, simple stuff. So things where we don't need to have a bunch of multiple processes, this is still actually fine. But obviously, when it comes to our more complex systems, our laptops, our smartphones, servers, we need something different, especially if we're going to be able to utilize caching. So here you can see we add just a little bit onto this diagram. We have our CPU that asks for some data that lives in some virtual address. And we have this MMU, our memory management unit, that does the translation for that virtual memory and knows where to find that virtual memory address in physical memory, like in our main, it can map a virtual address to a physical address and get that actual data from our main memory. Does anybody have questions so far? I feel like I'm going pretty quickly, but maybe this stuff is like not too bad, right? A little, this is some review, hopefully.
I have a question, Caitlin. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Does this all go back to you saying that like the fuse bomb or whatever had a different address?
Yeah.
Okay, so essentially yeah, so that was like a virtual memory address that maps back to a physical location.
Exactly. Okay, so those virtual addresses can be a little bit different, like depending on how things get mapped.
Okay.
So you can't count on that like being the same every time, even between processes. So yes, that's exactly correct. So let's talk about our address spaces. We have a linear address space, which is just like an ordered set of contiguous non-negative integer addresses. So from 0 to like whatever, however like large that set is. We have our virtual address space, which is this, a set of n equals 2 in virtual addresses. And remember, our virtual address space is going to be the same for all processes on a system. That's what we just looked at in like, whoops, in all these different processes. So our virtual address space for all of these processes is the same, right? And then we also have our physical address space, which is some set of m equals 2m physical addresses. And that will differ depending on your system. Our physical addresses have to do with the amount of DRAM that we have. So our virtual address space is going to, in general, be larger than our physical address space. And you can think of our virtual, you can think of like our virtual address space as like a DRAM cache, right? So this is just another version of that caching. And we'll see how in just a second. So why do we do this? So again, this is another way that we can use our main memory more efficiently. We can use that DRAM that has a limited amount of space on it as a cache for like this larger virtual address space that we utilize. And this also simplifies things for our processes. And and simplifies memory management on a system because each process gets that same uniform linear adjust space, which is great. And again, it also helps, is what allows for that fundamental aspect of processes where they think that they are alone in the system. It isolates those address spaces. So even though they may have the same virtual addresses in memory, they're not going to interfere with each other's memory or overwrite data. And also this will keep user programs from being able to access like privileged kernel info and code. So we can like keep things isolated this way as well. So it actually, the virtual memory does a lot for us. Okay. So if we look at this, and remember I said, let's think about virtual memory as let's think of DRAM as like a cache for a virtual memory. So we have this virtual memory here that's bigger than our physical memory. And this kind of looks similar to other like cache diagrams we've already looked at. So conceptually, our virtual memory is an array of whatever n contiguous bytes stored on disk. The contents of that array on disk are cached in physical memory. So here we've got, these cache blocks are actually quite a bit bigger, and they're called pages than the cache blocks we're working with before. And that's because we're working further down in memory. So when it's more expensive for us to go grab memory, so we grab a little bit more at a time so that we don't have cache misses as often, and we don't have to go back and grab memory as often, hopefully. So you can see here, we've got this virtual memory. We've got our virtual pages on the side there, virtual page 0, 1, 2, 3, et cetera, until the end. And then we have our physical memory over here. We've got our physical pages that's on the right-hand side there, and that's physical page 0, 1, et cetera, et cetera. And the virtual page doesn't necessarily correspond with like what the physical page number is. Here we've got our virtual page 1 is in cache, and it gets mapped to physical page 1. Our virtual page 4 is mapped to physical page 5. And so we have all of that, and this should look really familiar to you. This should just, in your head, you should be like, yes, this is how caches work. And this is just a little bit more complicated version of a cache. So everybody right here, we should all be on the same page. Like I said before, so our cache organization here is a little bit different than the cache organization we had higher up in memory. Like I said, because we have a much higher miss penalty. So we think about what we were talking about earlier about how we have to design and program with misses in mind and minimizing misses. It gets even more expensive here. So our DRAM is about 10 times slower than our SRAM, and our disk is 10,000 times slower than DRAM. So think about the extra time that it takes if you don't have something already cached to go get that and read it or write to it, right? So some of the ramifications of that are these larger block sizes. Like I said before, we have pages, which are typically 4 kilobytes, sometimes 4 megabytes. We also utilize, if you'll remember, we talked about the different different associative caching we can have. Here we have fully associative caching. So any virtual page can be placed in any physical page. And this cannot be done in hardware the way that some of our caching can, because this requires a really large, complex mapping function. So this is much different than our cache memories. This has to be implemented in software, and it gets implemented in your operating system. So these are like highly sophisticated and expensive replacement algorithms. Again, too complicated for us to like leave to hardware. We have to write those into our software. And you remember when we talked about our writing, this is write back rather than write through. And if you think about that, the reason for that is probably pretty obvious. Like, we don't want to be writing back to memory back to disk every time we do a write, right? We would want to be able to defer that write for as long as we possibly can. So any of our writes with virtual memory will be write back, which as a reminder means that like those writes to disk are not going to happen until that virtual memory, until that cache memory is about to get evicted. And then we'll check those dirty bits to see if some data has been changed, and we'll do all of our writes then. So we just do things a little bit differently here because our cache misses are so expensive. And also, the way that we are able to do this, we utilize this data structure called the page table, which is an array of page table entries or PTEs that are going to map our virtual pages to physical pages. So we have our page table here. And you can see we've got our page table entries from 0 to 7, and we have either stuff that is in DRAM that has been basically cached, that's in our virtual memory, and we have stuff that isn't, that's still on disk. So if we look at our page table entry 1 here, we have our virtual page 1, and that is in our physical memory. We do have that like in our DRAM cache. So that's great. That's ideal for us to have our virtual pages like in our physical pages here in DRAM. The other thing that can happen, obviously, is that at some point you'll probably want to call some memory that is not in our physical memory yet, that is still on disk, and at that point we will have to go to disk and pull that into our DRAM and evict some virtual page that hasn't been used for a while, ideally, and bring that new page in, as we do in other caches. And this page table, this data structure, is maintained by the kernel. Each process has its own page table. So whenever your MMU needs to fetch some memory, it'll look up in the page table where that is and then like extract that physical address of that virtual page, right? Does that make sense? I feel like I just gave you a lot of stuff. Does anybody have questions? And I may be able to answer them. Cool. The same thing that we have in regular cache, we have with our virtual memory. Here we call hits, page hits. So that is a reference to that virtual memory word that is in physical memory already. It's already in our DRAM for us. So that's easy. That is, we're used to what a hit is. So hits are good. Of course, we also have misses. Whenever it comes to virtual memory, when we have a miss, it's called a page fault. And that's going to actually trigger a hardware exception. So if we look for something in our physical memory, in our DRAM, and it's not already there, and we have to go to disk, that's going to be, that miss is going to be a fault. I think this next, okay, so here we go. I'm going to finish this slide up, and then we can be done for today. So whenever we have a page fault, that's going to trigger an exception in hardware, which we are now at this point, I think, familiar with exceptional control flow. So we have this fault. We're going to have a handler that's going to deal with this fault. Our page fault handler is going to decide which page in our DRAM, which like virtual page is going to get evicted. Right here, we're going to evict virtual page 4. And then we're going to copy. What are we looking? What were we looking for? 3, I guess, is what we were putting into our DRAM that wasn't there before. So we'll place that new page into our physical memory, that new virtual page. And once that happens, the handler will hand it back to actually the instruction that caused that exception will re-execute, and then the program will continue executing. So we wait until a miss to do these copies, again, because this is all expensive stuff we're dealing with here. So that is is known as demand paging. I think that's it for that guy. Okay, cool. Okay, so I'm gonna stop here. If anyone has questions, you're welcome to ask now, and I will attempt to answer them, but hopefully that was nothing too crazy, right? Cool. Okay, like I said, I will be available for Shell Lab help starting around like 3:30 or so. I'll jump onto the Zoom. So if you need help debugging, I will do my best. Sometimes, like I said, this debugging takes longer than like any of us think it should, because sometimes it just like figuring out these bugs, especially when it comes to like synchronization and stuff like that, it can be really dicey. So try and get that done early. If you need to use a grace day, use a grace day. If you need help later, just email us. Keep us up to date. Like, there are some people that I've heard a lot from, whether they're like doing okay or struggling, that I like know what's going on with. And there's some people that I haven't heard from at all. And I hope that you guys are all okay. If you are struggling a little bit, please reach out. Like, no judgment. Like, I'm not going to be like, how do you not understand eval? Like, how do you not get this? I will not at all be like that. None of us will. We just want you guys to get to a point where it makes sense to you. And we'll do what it takes to do that. And in some ways, like, by not being limited to like, you know, physical campus space, it's actually easier now, although in some ways it is more difficult. But that's it. I don't want to keep you guys any longer.
Hey, Caitlin, quick question.
Yes.
You said you're coming on at 3:30. Is that going to be in this meeting room or the help hours meeting room?
I think I might do. Okay, here's my question. Is the last time I went into the help hours meeting room, I wasn't a host. And I don't know if that's because you were already the host or if I don't have the host key. But maybe if you want to message me the host key for that one, because I think if you sign in as Matt, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I don't have Matt's login.
I'll send you his login. Cool. He made it simple so we could all like use it.
Okay, sweet. So I will be in the help hours Zoom. So that's where you guys can find me starting at like 3:30. If I'm not there yet, give me like 10 minutes. It should give me plenty of time to get what I have to get done, but you know, things happen. So yeah, I will talk to you guys later. Thank you. It's good to see you. Hope everybody's well.
Peace.
Bum, bum, bum.